Hello everyone and welcome back to the Stats for Lefties podcast. Today I am interviewing Alex Chowlow, the trans officer for Labour Students, the student wing of the Labour Party, and co-chair of Labour for Trans Rights. For the first time I talked to someone who is still a committed member of the Labour Party, so that's new for this show. I think that you'll find it very interesting to hear from them. Let's get into it. So I thought to start right off with a question about trans rights and politics, because you're very involved in both. Speaking as someone who's active in politics, what would you like to see the government enact for trans people in a practical sense? So in other words, when somebody says trans rights, what does that mean to you?
So obviously we're on the Stats for Lefties podcast. So I, in preparation for this question, I've pulled a few stats. They're not, you know, not lighthearted stats, because, you know, it is very challenging being trans and non-binary in the UK in 2023. But these are from Stonewall. Almost half of trans and non-binary people have experienced hate crime or gender identity related violence. And that's old data. So we can probably assume that, you know, that number is even higher now. 25% of trans and non-binary people have experienced homelessness in their lifetimes. That's way above what the national average is for homelessness. Two-thirds of trans and non-binary people who have tried to access medical transition care have not been satisfied with the medical care they've received. And it's obviously a matter of like public record that the medical, like the process of trying to get medically transitioned in this country is like incredibly onerous, incredibly intrusive, and very bureaucratic. So like in light of all this, the only kind of baseline assumption that you can make is that our society and our politics are just institutionally not geared for trans people, for LGBTQ people. And any kind of work around trans rights and trans liberation, you eventually have to just hit the point that you can't tinker around the edges. And the only system that will work for the LGBTQ plus community is just a root and branch transformation of how society works. That involves, you know, massively investing in the NHS. It involves a massive project of like, you know, housing provision, and making it so that, you know, trans and non-binary people don't have to, aren't forced into like relationships of abuse, because otherwise the alternative would be homelessness. It involves, you know, like making society and making things nicer for people, making things fairer, because ultimately we know that prejudice, repression increase when people are economically precarious, when things seem generally bad, as they do right now in the UK in 2023. And on top of that, you know, in the short term, trans rights means sorting out our incredibly outdated gender recognition system. You know, the Gender Recognition Act is not fit for purpose at all. And as we've seen in recent months, even kind of ameliorative attempts to fix that are met with severe resistance. And also, you know, for trans and non-binary people at the moment in this country, we need a far better mental health service. We need to be able to access mental health services far easier, and we need better medical care. So basically what I'm trying to say is it's incredibly expansive.
Marvelous. Well, that's a really expansive answer, like you say. But yes, it's absolutely wild, because we scheduled this, I believe, before Kate Forbes came out with all her spiel about like how not only terrible the gender recognition reform bill was, but how terrible gay marriage was and how terrible sex outside of wedlock was.
Yeah, that was weird. I think what really struck me about Kate Forbes is how like she has consistently come out with loads of transphobic talking points, and obviously was resisting the gender reform bill, and now she's only getting attention because she started talking about other things.
Yes. Well, I kind of want people to ask her, like, do you think, like, you know, the Earth was created in 7 days or something? But yes, so linked to the first question, you talked about lots of different kinds of policies about the NHS, investment, housing, and a lot of those things are things that people expect the Labour Party to do. But when it comes to trans rights in particular, the Labour Party has lost a lot of trust from trans people. And I'm not trying to relitigate the issue. I know that you've been critical of the leadership on this as well. So what I wanted to ask instead was, what do you think the party could do that might restore some of that trust and reassure people?
So I think there's like one really simple start that Labour could do to like help LGBTQ plus people gain trust in the party, and that's removing the whip from Rosie Duffield, somebody who should have had the whip removed many years ago. I think it's really problematic how the Labour leader has been using the Labour whip as like his own personal kind of like plaything. Like until Rosie Duffield is no longer a Labour MP, I can't really see how, like, I can understand why trans people would look at the party and be like, how can we possibly trust that? That's a really hard thing for me to say. And it's why it's kind of like my soul. Well, you know, like my project at the moment is just trying to get the Labour whip removed from Rosie Duffield. Until that happens, I don't think any meaningful reconnection with the trans community can be had. And it's absolutely gutting to say that. But aside from that particular point, there are obviously members of the PLP that have said similar things to Rosie Duffield on like self-ID, on various other things. And I think the next stage of the project reconnecting with trans people who've left the party, is making sure there's some kind of definition of transphobia in place, or some kind of you know, safeguarding so those kind of views can't be held in the PLP. I'm like a proponent of, you know, mandatory reselections for all MPs, and I think that especially applies in this case where, like, I was a Canterbury member, right, up until 2020. I campaigned for Rosie Duffield in 2019 very earnestly. You know, I was really enthusiastic about the party at that point. And obviously then, immediately after the election, almost, as it felt, she suddenly, like, turns her back on our community and everything I feel like I stand for. It's not right for me not to have any way of, like, recalling her as a Canterbury member, right? So that's right.
No, exactly. Although I remember being just stunned by the fact that she won her trigger ballot easily, because there was all this talk about how members in the seat wouldn't stand for it. And yet when it came down to it, there were a lot of people, I think, who just couldn't, a lot of cis people, I mean, who couldn't be bothered to, like, because this is the thing, right? Trigger ballot, and this is the problem with them, it requires confrontation. Requires you to have an argument with your MP, which a lot of people don't want to do. But, you know, I think it's necessary, you know, and it would be necessary with reselection mandatory as well, is you have to be willing to say, no, this is too much. We disagree with you and we want to vote in someone else. And it seems a lot of people aren't willing to take that step. Unless it's Sam Tarry for some reason. That's it. No one else. Just Sam Tarry. Oh, yeah, he got triggered, but he won the reselection. That was, yeah, I mean, I wasn't too surprised by Byrne being triggered, because his initial selection was so close as well. As I think, because his majority is so massive, people kind of forget that when he won in 2019 for the selection, I think he only won by about 10 votes. And so him being triggered, it being contentious, I mean, it's like one of the safest seats in the country. So while it was disappointing to see him triggered, I wasn't too surprised by it, as I think other people were, because him winning reselection by a, you know, single digit margin, it makes sense. It's just a lot of people want that seat. It's just like, if you get this seat, and this is the problem with Labour MPs, right? You get that seat, you are there for the next 30 years. That's what happened with Kate Hoey. She was there for like 30 years, and it was impossible to get rid of them. Which is why, yeah, it feels as if removing the whip from somebody is the only way to deselect them at this point. But I also wanted to ask you about sort of policy things you think Labour might be able to do? Because on paper, of course, they've committed to self-identification, but it feels very undermined by the party going out and saying things like, we don't believe in trans women playing sports. We don't believe in 16 and 17-year-olds self-IDing. And these are, of course, these are policy stances as well. So do you think the party's commitment to self-ID is enough, or could they go further?
Their on-paper policy is pretty good. Their on-paper policy for years now on self-ID has been pretty good. I haven't much to, you know, there might be something here or there, you know, to object to, or they could go further on. But the on-paper policy isn't bad. As you suggest, what is bad is the shadow cabinet going out and undermining it. And like, until certain elements of the shadow cabinet like stop doing that, it is kind of worthless.
But Labour's always been quite slow on thing, on like LGBT issues in government, and I don't expect the next one to be that much different. Unless, of course, you know, there's pressure on them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of willingness, I think, on the part of, you know, like people like Annalise Dodds in the Shadow Cabinet to reach out to trans voices in the party across the country to listen, to push stuff forward. But I do feel the impression that certain parts of the party are kind of being undermined by a less sympathetic leadership, or a leadership willing to equivocate on trans rights.
I didn't want to ask you only about trans rights. That wouldn't be fair. So the next question was about Labour students. So you're on the Committee of Labour Students, which, for those who don't know, is the second incarnation of Labour students. The first one was disaffiliated from the party after a lot of criticism. And this one is new, and it's more run directly by the party. So someone who's involved with it, what is different in your perspective? Because people may have some opinions of Labour students that don't reflect the new organisation.
Yeah, Labour Students is really interesting. So the original organisation was NOLS, National Organisation of Labour Students. It was disaffiliated from the party by the NEC, the left-led NEC, as it was in 2019, because NOLS was so problematic, basically. NOLS was incredibly undemocratic. They were one of the last kind of strongholds of pro-tuition fee rhetoric in the student movement and in the party for a very long time. So basically, the decision was made to disaffiliate NOLS, which was at that point a socialist society. So, you know, kind of a third-party group that was affiliated to the party. So basically, the NEC and the last committee of Young Labour formed a working group to essentially develop a new wing of the party, which would represent Labour students, kind of on similar terms to Young Labour. The elections for that first inaugural national committee for the new Labour students were in summer. The momentum-backed left slate won a majority of positions on that committee. Which was good. The other new thing from that point was obviously the establishment of my role, trans officer, the first trans officer in Labour Party structures. I believe it was the previous Young Labour committee, many of whom were like amazing, you know, young comrades and brilliant socialists and amazing on trans rights, pushed very hard for that position to be there, and hopefully to be kind of like almost pilot scheme for other parts of the party developing a similar role. But yeah, so since we got those positions in summer, we've been fighting hard in the party on free education. Many people will have noticed Starmer's kind of equivocated on whether or not the party is pro or anti tuition fees. Labour students, as of a few weeks ago, is very proudly anti tuition fees. Pro-free education, pro-bring back maintenance grants. Because ultimately, if we can't represent students in that way, what are we for? So yeah, it's a very long and complex history of Labour students.
Yeah, so you would say that they're sort of different from the previous Labour students in that it's more democratic, more left-wing because of the elections, and it's more sort of run directly by the party rather than what was a socialist society, so something more independent.
There's a lot more grassroots kind of collaboration with Labour clubs as well, kind of on the ground. There are, I think, 50-odd active Labour clubs around the country, and it's kind of like a really good power base for for the Labour Party, and a lot of them are, you know, very left wing as well, as you expect from from university campus Labour clubs.
So the final question, formal question, was: you are the first person I've had on this show who has been committed to staying in the Labour Party, because everyone I've interviewed thus far has been people who have left or who haven't joined. We have Matt, who left the Labour Party, Chris Jarvis, who's in the Greens. The question is, like, why do you remain a member, given that you obviously have disagreements with the leadership? And why should other progressive leftists join or stay in the party? And I say this to someone who has left, so...
I think it's firstly, like, for me to say that I completely understand and sympathise with leaving the party. It's not always easy being, like, either a pro-trans Labour member or a socialist Labour member. Neither of those things have been easy in the last couple of years. I'm certainly not, like, you know, naive to how difficult it is to be in this party at times, especially with kind of, like, the developments and certain things that, you know, the new kind of leadership have been, well, they're not new anymore, rather, but the leadership have been quiet about, and certain things they've been loud about. But I suppose my reasons for staying are both because I do not think that progressive change in this country, the vast majority of it, is going to come from the Labour Party. It's going to come from a Labour government. I think there's always a case for staying in and fighting than just not having any kind of say at all. I think it also comes down to, like, you know, we are, the left is being driven out. They are trying to drive us out, and I don't want to assist in that. I would rather maintain our power. You know, like, the Labour Party was set up as a socialist party by trade unions. Those trade unions are still there. They make things like 2015 to 2019 possible. I'm not, like, myself willing to abandon a party that, like, the left ran just a few years ago.
One of the reasons why I do sympathize with people who remain as well, because it's not very easy. It's one of the reasons I left was because for my own personal mental health, it's not very pleasant to be constantly told, you are not welcome, go away, which is quite literally what Starmer said today. But on the point of the left recently ran the party, I suppose an important question would be, do you think that the left, as you've experienced it, has actually learned any lessons from that? Because obviously we ran the party and we failed. And failed to such an extent that Corbyn himself is no longer a Labour MP. And a lot of people have been excluded from running for Parliament. What in your experience has the left learned from that?
Because we're in such a state of, I think, still, there is a sense of, you know, defeatism. And no, I don't think anybody is talking realistically that we're going to be running the party again within a couple of years.
Well, it does feel as if people think that, right? It feels as if the only, like, plan is just wait for Starmer to fail and then swoop in and say, well, we were right. And it's like, well, it doesn't... Like you say, that's not really a realistic prospect.
I don't see a route to that personally. I think waiting for, like, your opponents to mess up and then thinking that's your only option is, like, it's not a very good game plan.
Well, to be fair, worked for Starmer.
Yeah,
it worked very well.
But it worked for Starmer in very different circumstances, because obviously they can rely on a constant, like, weaponization against the left. When the left are running the party, they can rely on the hostile media.
Oh, no, I meant it worked for Starmer against the Tories.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
True. But it took 13 years, right? I think the left has probably learned that if we're in control, we should probably use it to be a bit more antagonistic. I don't think the strategy of conciliation for however many years has done us many favours in the medium term. But ultimately, you know, Labour is always a fairly long-term project, and it will be a long while before the left is in any position of power in the party again. That's just, I think, a fact. But that does still mean that, like, the left has to have an active presence in the party. It has to still stay. And I think there's, it's like important to say as well, like people who have left, I completely understand reasons for leaving, but also your like engagement with the party can fluctuate and that's fine. And you can stay in the party and do and maintain local kind of power. Like having CLPs and stuff in the control of the left is a good thing. Trying to like teach people and like run political education events in your area about socialism, about trade union movement, about the climate, they are good and worthwhile things that will have long-term benefits. And it doesn't like preclude you doing trade union work or climate organizing or international solidarity organizing. None of those things are precluded necessarily by being in the Labour Party.
I would normally have, obviously I asked all the questions, I would normally have moved on to the fun half, but you've been so efficient at answering the questions. I must say, I could definitely see why you're involved in politics, because you're very good at it.
Thank you, I think. Thank you.
Yeah, no, very precise answers. Is there anything that you would like to plug, like your Twitter account?
Well, I'd love to plug Labour for Trans Rights, as always, which is, of course, the campaign. please come and help.
Marvellous. And your Twitter is...
at Charalau _... Alex, I think.
Yes. Thank you very, very much for coming on, Alex. It's been very kind of you.
I hope I was, you know, fairly lucid and I was
very much so. As I say, very very, very capable interviewee. But yes, I shall let you go. Thank you so much again. As always, I wanted to finish by saying a particularly strong thank you to the people who've signed up as comrades on Patreon. Alex Wilson, Barry James, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick Mikatir, Neil Barton, Patrick Lefebvre, Pavel Kazimowski, Ruth Holliday, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, Juditha De Silva, and Joseph Bailey. Really wonderful people. Thank you so much, guys. You make what I do possible, and I love you for it.